continuing with Connie Mayer on 21st June 78.
But there were other things going on in the ranch. Doppler navigator schemes and I forget what else.
That's when McLean came out of, I believe.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And there was a whole group of 5 or 10 people who were working on other projects having to do with microwave techniques. And at that time, they split off and went into a different branch of the lab. And what was left was dedicated to radio astronomy.
So what was the rough growth? Then you say there were 3 or 4 full-time equivalents, so to speak, before 53 or 4. How many once the branch was established, would you say?
I don't remember. Probably 15. Maybe 20.
And that sort of level it stayed at?
No, then it grew. It grew to a maximum of about 25 to 28. And then it started declining.
Right. When was that peak reached?
Oh, in the 60s, I guess.
Mid-60s?
Earlier than.
Yeah. Okay.
And it stayed at about that level up until about the latter part of the 60s. And that was when the part of the reason for that increase was the added on radar astronomy.
Oh, yes, that's right.
And then in the late 60s, that was added off.
Whatever that means.
Well, the project was terminated.
Right. And then also,
still at that time, it was still all the people in the radio astronomy branch, but some of the people in were not working on radio or radar astronomy. They were working on other things.
Okay, well, while we're talking about these general questions, do you have any thoughts on what were the ingredients that contributed to the success of the radio astronomy branch, particularly in the 50s? Well, that's the basic question.
Yeah. Two strong factors were the 50-foot dish and the technical capability. We could put together decent receivers, centimeter wavelengths. We had a good, large centimeter wavelength antenna.
Mm-hmm.
So the two things together provided good facilities for doing radio astronomy in a range where nobody else had good facilities.
Right. You had very little competition, actually, in many of those projects.
Yeah, for quite some time, a few years at least. And I guess, in addition to that, I had good people. They weren't trained in astronomy, but they were trained in either physics or electronics.
Mm-hmm.
It's fairly easy to pick up basic astronomy.
Would another thing perhaps be the whole support of the atmosphere? I mean, you had the Navy was willing to keep you funded at a reasonably high level, of course.
Yeah, not necessarily at a high level, but sustained funding was definitely possible.
Yeah.
In fact, you didn't have to worry about it. You're going to have any money next year.
Next year's grant, yeah. Yeah, that's right. Well, along this same line, do you have any thoughts on, it's somewhat puzzling to me, why U.S. radio astronomy had a very slow start relative to particularly the British and the Australians? Do you have any thoughts on how that came about?
Well, yeah, I guess more thoughts on how it came about than why. I don't know why. I think one factor was particularly places like Australia and possibly England. And certainly Australia and the Netherlands, they were small countries. They could only devote a certain amount of effort to science, so they had to pick something where they could be a significant have a significant impact on the field. So you wouldn't go into high energy physics. So. And radio astronomy is a good thing, and they had the same kind of situation we had at NRL, where they had people who were trained in radar and had surplus equipment, which could be used for radio astronomy.
Mm-hmm.
And the only other basic difference I can think of is that for one reason or another, they thought probably equipment and funding limitations, primarily, I guess. They thought in terms of interferometers and got all these ingenious schemes for doing things with interferometers
right.
and arrays.
And, yeah, that's certainly,
There's a lot of the impact they had, particularly England in Australia, just because they were using interferometer type techniques.
That's right.
And they isolated out discrete sources, compositions on them, and so forth.
Right. So you're saying basically that the people, for instance, in the radiation lab, many of which did go into nuclear physics, had many more options in that they could go into big science because more funds were available, whereas in a smaller country you had pick more carefully.
Yeah, and there might even have been a national type thing where the country runs into big things.
Right, I mean,
people
Americans...
People along with it.
Yeah. I mean, U.S. science does tend to think the biggest and best. Tends to think along those lines. And NRL, of course, was one exception to this, having gotten started very early, although it was a very small effort until really the mid-50s, as you just said. The other exceptions, I guess, were Cornell had a small program. And was there anyone else besides Grove River?
Well, the Bureau of Standards had a small effort for a long time.
Right, which was Reber.
Later absorbed Reber,
yeah.
For a while. That was only, I think, most of 2 or 3 or 4 faculty at any one time.
And then Harvard, starting in 52 or 3. In the late 40s, I think there was really only those 3 groups. MBS, with Reber, and Cornell here.
Yeah, maybe you're right. I can't think of any else.
Do you remember any effort at that time to the reason that, well, the U.S. should be in this, and so therefore this is another reason to keep the radio effort, the radio astronomy effort going in NRL. In other words, for nationalistic considerations, is that ever part of this?
Well, I think those of us who were in it felt that way, but I'm not sure it was any national idea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Probably still isn't.
Okay, now to a few specific projects. The eclipse expeditions, which before we talked about the scientific results of them and some of the troubles you had, and I was wondering if you could relate some of the details of, in particular, this one off the coast of Brazil, I believe, of the Navy destroyer and so forth, to some of the recollections you have of getting those things together and actually carrying them out.
Yeah, that one I didn't participate directly.
Oh, you didn't go on that one?
No.
I see.
That was shortly after I got involved at all. How I got involved was Hagen had been using straight total power receivers. And lots of problems with gain variations.
Mm-hmm.
So he told me to see if I couldn't do something about that. So I tried with the crude DC amplifiers and things that were sitting around. Told them I didn't think we could do anything with it. I have to go to the Dickey radiometer. Well, he had assigned another guy who was in the branch temporarily. Well, not temporarily, but he didn't stay long. to put together a dickey system, but he hadn't got very far. So then I took that over and put together a dickey radiometer along with Ken Decker. And I don't remember for sure, but I guess we put two of them together. And one of them was taken on this ship for the eclipse, and the other one we put in a 10-foot dish on the roof.
Mm-hmm.
And looked at the sun on the day of the eclipse from here.
It's partial right from here. Oh, is it?
No. I think so.
I guess it's
just to see what the sun was doing. No real reason.
Yeah.
But the only thing I know about the expedition was they had a lot of trouble. One of the troubles being the antenna, I think, was up on the mast and had a hard time keeping it pointed at the sun, as you can imagine. And they didn't really, as I remember, get the data that's very usable.
Mm-hmm. How would they keep it pointed at the sun?
I think they had two monkeys on dials. Something like that.
Just trying to keep the signal optimized, I mean, maximized.
So, that's all about all I can think of on that one, except Hagen did pick up an electronic technician who wanted to get out of the Navy. He came in for grants, and he just retired a few months ago, John Eccles.
Oh, I see. I didn't realize that's how he...
Yeah, he's an excellent technician.
You might be interested to know that the Russians also did observe that eclipse from the ship with a low-frequency array.
Yeah.
And they were steering that array by moving the whole ship. It was at dock, and they would just change the ropes and the hawsers and everything.
Yeah, as I remember it, they didn't get the results either.
Well, they got some minimal stuff, but wasn't all that successful. So you didn't go on that one. Did you go on the next one?
Yeah.
Which was which?
Attu.
It was Attu.
Yeah. That was in 1950. Oh, Hagen cranked up a bigger effort for that. Yeah. We put together radiometers, I believe it was 10 centimeters, 3 centimeters, maybe just 3, I don't know. But at least 3 centimeters and 8 millimeters. With portable antennas. And Gert Reber put together a system that I've forgotten, but something like 600 megahertz,
mm-hmm.
which he took along. And in addition, Hagen borrowed a big eclipse telescope from the Bear Standards. Huge tube, about a foot and a half in diameter, about 20 feet long.
Mm-hmm.
So we set up all this junk on a old airstrip sticking out into the ocean, and got it all working. And the day of the eclipse had a typhoon. So, took data anyway, but needless to say, it wasn't much good.
I gather this was the only place that the eclipse was hitting land.
Well, I don't think it was the only place, but it might have been one of the few places where it was feasible to set something up.
Yeah. Yeah, I've seen those pictures where you're rather heavily attired in rain and cold.
Wrapped up in plastic sheets. Oh, anyway, we got very raggedy foot scurves. Very marginal resistance.
Nevertheless, the effort persisted.
Yeah, the next one was Khartoum. And I guess that was an even bigger effort. And I put together two radiometers for that one, one at 10 and one at 3. These were 9.5 and 3 or something like that, centimeters. And by that time we got more sophisticated and had them built on trailers. So the whole trailer could be transported,
mm-hmm.
antenna on it, and all the equipment. And then Hagen, McEwen, and Gibson put together an 8-millimeter system with a cylindrical parabola, which gave a fan beam. The idea was to line up the fan beam with the track of the moon. get less of a sector scan or
right.
a strip scan. And I guess still have the Eclipse camera, plus Eclipse movie cameras. I didn't go on that trip either. And the results there were fairly good, but I guess as I remember, the main problem there was that too much solar activity. We had these big jobs and clusters covering and uncovering active regions.
Yeah, you mentioned that before. Did you? Was this all shipped using U.S. Navy ships?
I think so.
Mm-hmm. So you had to have it all ready probably several months beforehand.
Oh, yes. It was like a year's effort to get everything built and put together and packed up and spares, and provide spares for everything.
And then
motor generators and
then the persons
cables.
Themselves had to be gone for probably at least a month, 6 weeks, I call that. In those days, you didn't fly over, I guess, either.
Well, yeah. Probably mats. Mm-hmm. See, I guess for Khartoum, I actually have one of these big troop transport planes, type planes, carry them over and bring them back.
So,
yeah, they were tremendous efforts.
In retrospect, it would seem to me that they probably weren't worth it. Would you agree with that, or if you think of the man years that went into them versus the scientific results obtained?
Well, up until that point, I never got a clean Eclipse grid. The next one in Sweden, the sun was well behaved, the weather was reasonable, and got good results, good clean Eclipse grids. And more respectable scientific output. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I personally probably not have opted to put the effort in that direction.
Okay, another question I had was the detection of the linear polarization in the Crab Nebula. I noticed that in abstracts for two different articles, that in the first one, published in 57, you quoted 7% at 3 centimeters wavelength. And then in 59, with Sloniker in AAS talk, you quoted 3%. And I was wondering, do these actually refer to the same thing and you improved your measurements, or are these different?
Excuse me, 7% is 3 centimeters and 3% is 10 centimeters.
Ah, okay.
That's 9 centimeters. I believe.
Okay. What was the critical thing that allowed you to detect this polarization?
Well, it's going to the higher frequency. The degree of polarization is higher, less depolarization, parrot irritation.
So the polarimeter itself wasn't that tricky to build once you were able to have the high frequency radiation?
The initial detection didn't use polarimeter at all. Initial detection was during measurements of Venus, which were carried on for a period of 3 or 4 weeks. So we had the opportunity to use Crab Nebula as a calibration object. And with a linearly polarized antenna and with altitude azimuth mount, we got a change of parallactic angle of a bit sizable amount, 60 degrees or something like that. So we saw a definite systematic variation across the sky. So midway through the course of the experiment, we rotated the pole receiver by 90 degrees, and the systematic variation turned around to be what it should be for polarization. That was the initial detection. And we immediately set up a radiometer with a rotating feed to get improved measurements. And that was all 3 centimeters.
Right. Now, was this accidentally discovered?
No. We were looking for it. See, people have been looking for a number of years particularly, I guess, Lester Hart and Charlie Seeger in Holland had at least one or two prizes.
Right. I told you once in the movies at high school.
That may be, it had been something that people were looking for.
Why would you use it for a calibration source, though, if you suspected you might detect polarization? Or did you have yet another one?
Well, we used it, the calibration was primarily pointing at intensity.
Okay.
In other words, we wanted to feel secure that we were looking at Venus.
Right. And before you rotated it 90 degrees, was there some doubt that it might be due to an antenna gain effect that you didn't know about or something like this?
There was no doubt in our mind.
Against the rest of the world.
Well, you have to do it.
Yeah. So it was pretty clear, right, even at first?
Sure. Both the Venus and the Crab Nebula experiments were planned experiments, they weren't just chance.
Yeah, well, I knew the Venus was, but...
And the reason the Venus one was planned for several weeks up to inferior conjunctions to see if there was a phase effect.
Was this your second time on with Venus? That was your first time on with Venus. Well, that's right, you had to quit right at inferior conjunction. I remember you saying that you didn't have as much time as you would have liked to have had. I got the impression from re-listening to your tape that there was sort of your group, and then there was Hagen and McLean, and I guess Lily, their group. So you're sort of competing for a telescope now. Yeah. You having somewhat the lower hand since you were in charge of the branch. Another question I was wondering after re-listening was why you didn't go on to the 84-foot when it came into existence. In fact, I'm not quite sure what you worked on in the early 60s and very late 50s.
Well, we worked on mainly extensions of polarization measurements and measurements of planets. We looked at Venus several times, chasing this elusive phase effect.
With the 50-foot.
With the 50-foot, yeah.
This was even after the 84-foot existed.
Oh, probably. I guess so, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And polarization, out to other sources and other wavelengths to try to pin down the Faraday rotation, and also to see what the polarization of other sources was.
Mm-hmm.
And for example, one thing that we were doing that time period with polarization was in general, the variation of polarization of the wavelength wasn't all that interesting, except for the possibility of getting the Faraday rotation making some kind of SQC magnetoionic medium. But Cygnus A turned out to have this very peculiar spectrum, polarization spectrum,
mm-hmm.
where it dropped very sharply as you went toward longer wavelengths. Turned out to really turn down, and played around, it turned out it could be all puzzled out by having independent polarization in the two main components, which probably counter-rotate. At least the counter-rotation idea was the simplest one that would fill in.
Mm-hmm. Is that held up from synthesis maps?
Pardon?
Has that held up from synthesis maps?
As far as I know. And we extended the polarization margins from 3 to 10 centimeters. And then we went after other planets. That was.
Mm-hmm.
primarily what we were doing. Now, as to why we didn't go on the 84 foot, we did actually. But it wasn't very useful for polarization measurements because the instrumental polarization is high.
I see.
Something around 3%.
Also, I guess it couldn't go shorter than 10 centimeters.
But we did use that to some extent.
Were you involved in the 300 foot observations?
No.
That was Polonium's laundry.
Yeah, they started that up in home while I was at Caltech.
Were you a sabbatical time for you in Caltech? And what did you do there?
Oh, not much of anything. Mainly in terms of useful, supposedly useful work. Fooled around with trying to get a cool parent working that they had gotten about that time without a great deal of success. Unfortunately, it was bought in pieces. All that success from getting it put together.
What year was that?
Oh, I don't know, 61, 62, 63, something.
Mm-hmm. It would be interesting to know what your appraisal of the Caltech group was. An outsider's point of view. Were you impressed with what they were doing?
Or? Oh, yeah. Very much so.
And what were their strong points, would you say?
Well, I guess at that time, the... I guess their basic program was looking at radio source survey type things. Non-thermal sources.
CTA and CTB surveys,
yeah. And along about that time, Moffitt was doing his thing with source structure.
Mm-hmm.
And Kellerman was doing his thing with source spectra. They're graduate students. And
Barry Clark was doing his
Moffitt
thing.
Moffitt might actually have a postdoc. I mean, Barry Clark was doing something that nobody could figure out what he was doing exactly. And I guess some of the things that they had done along about that time had quite a bit of impact other than general source structure stuff and survey. They had done this interferometer stuff on Jupiter.
Oh, yes.
And defined the rocking of the polarization and the polarization and the whole bit to pretty well identify the radiation pulse.
Did you ever try polarization of the planets?
Oh, yeah.
And was this Jupiter just below sensitivity?
No, it was done, but that was at 21 centimeters.
So it turns, that's right.
That was
that's
done
right.
By Nutt.
Yeah.
That was done by McLean and Locke and Bruce Gary and mm-hmm. Al Miller. Using the 84 foot. Now, the higher frequency stuff, thermal radiation.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, one final question is the amalgamation of radio astronomy into optical astronomy or traditional astronomy. What recollections do you have of how that came about? Or do you think it still has not maybe yet come about in the 50s in particular and also in the 60s?
Well, it was always there to some extent, and there were always optical astronomers who were interested and eager to get results.
Were there any that you personally were in touch with in the 50s?
Yeah.
Who were they?
Well, I guess the main ones were Towns and Towns.
Yeah, he's a physicist.
And Kuiper, and to some extent, Menzel.
Mm-hmm.
And Bach. You know, Bach was interesting.
Oh, sure.
And to a minor extent, Greenstein.
But
there always were. Was that kind of interesting? I don't know. I don't really know what you mean by your question. There was also a lot of skepticism, of course.
Which was the dominant attitude? I mean, if you gave a paper at a AAAS meeting, was it only the radio astronomers you were talking to in that room to begin with?
Yeah, that probably is true, and it's probably also true that in the earlier days, there probably weren't very many papers given at Astronomical Society meetings that you're more likely to be given Gerson.
Mm-hmm.
You see, Radio Astronomy Commission University was very strong.
Right.
And it was a good meeting place for radio astronomy. And a lot of the things that they were talking about were mainly of interest to at least the details
to
the radio astronomer. But yeah, I think, you know, like, certainly the things like the initial identifications of radio sources without topologies, paramagnetron, Sydney Sunny, and so forth, they were certainly great interest to astronomers.
So, how do you look back on it? Do you look back upon it as optical astronomers, there were a minority of them that were very interested in, and the others sort of didn't have much to do with this upstart, or?
Well, there were probably a few who were kind of basically interested in the technique, new way of looking at things, and there were others who would become interested when it touched on what they were interested in.
Yeah.
Greenstein was interested in the measured radiation of H2 regions.
Mm-hmm.
Piper was interested in the measured Venus. People regarded it as a possibility for new information, of course, until things got a little bit sorted out. Nobody knew what it meant, and everybody was sort of confused, didn't know what to make of it.
Yeah.
Probably a little bit like X-ray astronomy's been the last few years.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like a separate group of people, and other people get interested when they see something that's along their line.
Mm-hmm.
They can use.
At what era would you place this getting sorted out for radio astronomy? When did this transition take place, would you say?
Well, it didn't take place all at once. But, when Sidney Say was first recognized, or for that matter, when galactic radiation was first recognized, nobody really had any good way to explain it. And when people started getting ideas on synchrotron radiation and so forth, it seemed like it could be explained as a non-thermal radiation, and things got a little better sorted out.
Yeah, that's good.
As long as nobody really had any idea what it was, it was much to talk about, except being that wonderful.
Do you think that was a basic reason for this communications gap, was that the traditional astronomer just was not familiar at all with radio techniques?
No, I don't think so. I think, as far as I know, by and large, now there probably are exceptions, the idea of non-thermal radiation in astronomical sources probably hadn't really been considered that much.
I agree with that. I think maybe you misunderstood my question. I was asking just a more general question. The fact that most traditional astronomers did not pay too much attention to radio astronomy, do you think that was aided by the fact that it was just so foreign to them as to what an antenna really did, and what an antenna temperature meant, and so forth, that it was just sort of too much for them to really comprehend what was going on, so they just ignored it?
You can probably say it that way, but I would say it differently.
Okay, how would you say it?
It's just not their thing. And they watch what the people who are doing it are doing. I feel like I watch X-ray astronomy.
Hmm.
That's not my thing.
Okay, well, that pretty much covers what I wanted to do. Thank you very much.
That ends the interview with Connie Mayer on 21 June 78.